You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Thank you all. And please join me in welcoming to the stage our congressional keynote speakers, Representative Brian Mast of Florida, and Gregory Meeks of New York. They will be introduced and interviewed by Fred Kemp, President and CEO of our partner organization, the Atlantic Council. Prior to assuming leadership of the Council, Fred was a successful author and a prize-winning reporter and editor at the Wall Street Journal, where he worked for more than 25 years. Please join me in welcoming our congressional keynote speakers.
So I've been looking forward to this all day. So welcome to this moderated conversation with the incoming chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Representative Brian Mast of Florida.
Thank you.
And the former chair of that same committee, Representative Gregory Meeks of New York, who remains ranking member of the committee. So Chairman Mast represents Florida's 21st district. I think that includes Mar-a-Lago, is that right?
Mar-a-Lago's right on the border. Oh, I tell people I go between Donald Trump and Betsy DeVos.
I'll hold my follow-up questions for the moment. A military veteran, operating Operation Enduring Freedom, recipient of the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart, lost both his legs while serving in Afghanistan in 2010. His maternal grandparents were immigrants from Mexico. He served in Congress since 2017. Chairman Meeks, a lawyer with his degree from Howard University, just down the road here, law degree, has served in Congress since 1998. Chair from 2021 to 2023, worked as assistant district attorney to the special narcotics prosecutor of the city of New York, before joining the Investigations Commission on Official Misconduct and Organized Crime. So I'm gonna get right into the questions, and then somewhere in the flow of the questions, we'll turn to all of you in the audience and ask you for your questions and have you identify yourself and to whom you want to ask your question. Your committee's one with a rich history. I won't list all the people who have been chairs, but one of them was John Quincy Adams. It gained status as a standing committee of the House of Representatives in 1822. Its antecedents date back as far as 1775, when the Continental Congress established a committee to correspond with friends abroad. So let's get started. Chairman Mast, people are talking about this as a uniquely perilous time. Wars in the Mideast, wars in Europe and the Middle East, competition tensions with China, competition for the commanding heights of technological change, artificial intelligence, quantum, et cetera. There's a whole world of stuff to look out here. How are you gonna go about setting your priorities?
Triage, tactically, strategically, make the big deal the big deal. Those are all things that we say constantly in the military, but the big deal for us is recognizing the different buckets that exist in Congress, authorizing and appropriating committees. We are an authorizing committee. And in part, I would say our role in authorizing, doing a comprehensive reauthorization of the State Department, has been allowed to lapse largely for the last 20 years. I believe 2002 was the last time it was done comprehensively. And so this is work that we will be eating and sleeping and breathing as members of the committee, is to make sure that we are prioritizing anything in any hemisphere or any continent, any part of the globe, by saying what are the buckets that we allow to go forward within the State Department, and then deciding should those remain the way that they are, do they need guardrails up around them, should they be dissolved, or should be new ones, we have new ones created. And that's just a little bit of the strategy to say how we'll move about working through that purposefully.
Really, really interesting. And we'll come back to the State Department question a little bit later. So in this job, how do you view bipartisan collaboration. How important is it to maintain? Where is it most useful? How are you going to handle questions of that?
This is one of those where you go back and forth. I got to answer two in a row.
I'm going to go to him next. That's fine.
You don't have to do two for him. It's okay. Look, I don't make bipartisanship a goal.
The chairman gets an extra question.
The goal is good policy for America. The goal is good policy that makes America the partner of choice. Does what we're doing make a nation say or a region say, yeah, those are the ones that we want to work with. That's the best partner for these reasons, for the short term and the long term, and we create that drumbeat. And if we have to get to that point, have different things come forward that they say, we need this, or we need this, or we want to see this change, and that helps get my vote, which makes it bipartisan, those are the things that you look at. But we don't look at it and say, my goal is just making something that has the passage of bipartisanship. No, the goal is what we're doing for our country, and hopefully that's bipartisan.
That's a great answer. Representative Meeks, what advice would you provide Chairman Mast from your own recent experience as chairman?
Well, number one, I'd say that if you're talking about state authorization, that is important. Fact of the matter is, we did pass a state authorization bill when I was the chair in 2021 for the first time in 20 years in a bipartisan manner, working together because we think that we know that the Foreign Affairs Committee is a committee of which we utilize our soft power. So that we don't, hopefully, as General Mattis said, don't have to use the hard power. But that's our committee, and then we have the Armed Services Committee, which does a lot of the hard power. So the hard power backs us up on the soft power to make sure that we get things done. And so as a result, we've always, whether, you mentioned, all of the former chairs, well, you mentioned one, John Quincy Adams, but if you look at it, although it wasn't called the House Foreign Affairs Committee at the time, talking to former chair, McCall, he will tell you Benjamin Franklin, because foreign affairs and dealing with our allies and friends and people across the world has always been significant and important. And we have been known as named by for a long period of time as the essential country of bringing people together. And I think that's what we talk about, and we need to do that in a bipartisan way, particularly when we're traveling, so folks don't look at the United States of America as a divided country in regards to our foreign policy. We generally say that the word would be, you leave the division when we cross the water's edge. And so that way we're talking and working together, and we're trying to figure out having these kind of conversations, because it should not be a Republican or a Democratic issue when we're talking about national security. And we take all things into consideration when we are moving in that direction. And so I think that working collectively, understanding that there's different views at times in regards to how do we obtain that. There's not one way that you accomplish a goal. And it is better, I think, overall, when we do things in a bipartisan way. We've done it before, and I hope that we can continue to do that, because when we've done it, it has sent a strong message to our allies particularly, but also to our adversaries, that the United States will rally together. And I'll give one example of that, which was really important, where there was, some changes of languages, et cetera, was right after October the 7th. We wanted to make sure that we had a strong bipartisan resolution condemning Hamas. And there was a way that we needed to do that so that everybody could get on board. We were successful at doing that, to have that message that there's nobody's going to divide the members of the United States Congress, on the support that we have for our ally, particularly in their time of need.
Yeah, stick with that for a minute. Give me one or two other examples, but maybe throw in one where it doesn't work, because I think you're both agreeing that it isn't bipartisanship in the service of bipartisanship, but it's bipartisanship in the service of what is the American interest. I think I'm hearing that from both of you, that's the key thing. But give me another example where it worked, and maybe give an example where you couldn't come together and why you couldn't come together.
Well, another example of coming together, of course, is with Russia's aggression to Ukraine. We worked together to try to make sure that Finland and Sweden were joining NATO because of the dangers of what, and the aggression of Vladimir Putin. And so we worked collectively and sent the same message to the Turks, for example, when they were holding up one of the accessions. So we let them know that there was no division there. They needed to make sure Sweden would be in the into NATO. So that's where we had an agreement. We also had an agreement when we dealt with, we worked very closely with outbound investments, which is really very important for the security of our country, to make sure that China and others like that are not getting or having access to vital chips and other types of equipment that would be a threat to our national security. So we worked very closely in that. We had basic disagreements on, for example, in dealing with Afghanistan, or at least the end result of Afghanistan. My viewpoint at that particular time was that when we look at Afghanistan, we need to look at it through the prism of 20 years, and not the prism of just the last couple of months, or the last few weeks, actually, of extracting our troops out of Afghanistan. And so we could not agree on that, so we've had, back and forth conversations and a number of hearings on that, where we did not have a complete agreement, because I thought that, and many on the Democratic side, that we should look at all of the history of Afghanistan from George W. Bush to Barack Obama to Donald Trump to Joe Biden. Others thought we just look at the last 3 or 4 weeks, so we could not have an agreement on how we should look at Afghanistan at the end.
Thank you for that. So Chairman Mass, one writes and thinks a lot about presidential transitions. Steve Hadley, former National Security Advisor, and who's going to be moderating the sort of passing of the baton keynote, the Jake Sullivan and Mike Waltz session to end the afternoon, and he wrote a masterful book on this called Handoff. You don't really have the same sort of thing. It's really Chairman McCaul to Chairman Mast, but on the other hand, you have a former chairman sitting behind you. How do you do your transition? What preparation have you undergone? How does this differ from a presidential transition?
I think there's so many things about this presidential transition that manifest something that probably the nation has never seen. And probably the genesis of that is the break between the two terms of the presidency, where the president has had these 4 years to reflect on what worked, what didn't work, what was successful, what was not successful, where has the world changed over those 4 years, where does there have to be a return to previous policies or an alteration of what policies were prior to the Biden, or prior to the first Trump administration or the Biden administration, or moving forward. So I think that number one changes into something that nobody has ever seen. But to go a little bit more specifically into how that transition is for me, to make a math problem for everybody in part, you have President Trump, of course, in Palm Beach, Florida. You have future Secretary of State, I believe, will be going through the ringer tomorrow or the next day, whatever day that is, over at the Senate, Marco Rubio from Miami, Florida. You have myself as Foreign Affairs Chair. You have our lead appropriator on State and Foreign Ops being Mario Diaz-Balart. You have National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, right? And the list goes on from there. But the point is, in that transition, that you see the importance of relationships and the history of us having worked together, having a more long-lasting trust in the opinions that we've shared with one another. All of those things absolutely play into the roles that we now play moving forward for the next two or four or however many years we have the opportunity to sit in these roles.
And as you undergo this, I mean, just give people a little bit of an insight into what's important for you, given your background, given your history. You're not as well known to this audience as a new chairman. That many people may not know that you're a volunteer for the Israeli Defense Forces. If that's something very important for you. On Ukraine, you voted against the funding, the last round of funding in Congress. Not entirely clear where the Trump administration will go on that. If you can share with the audience a little bit, what moves you coming into this position in foreign policy issues, and then how you will use that to guide your decisions and guide your chairmanship of the committee coming in with these really tough decisions.
Let me say it in a couple of ways. Right? The goal would be a platitude. Every diplomat and every dollar puts America first. That's not the easiest platitude to go out there and litigate and speak about when you're talking about foreign assistance, but absolutely there is that role and there is that mechanism to do it, of which I could elaborate on as well. But I think the questions you ask to get to that point, and these are questions that are not platitudes to me. Every single time that I have a foreign delegation or a diplomat or an ambassador, take your pick, every single time there's one of them in my office. I have, for those of you that have been in there, I have a sliding collegiate lecture board, Barker lecture board. I hide the things behind it that I don't want people to see, and I keep the things on the front that I do want people to see. And I have written on the front board three questions that I've had up there for years. And question number one is, what does America need from each country or region? Question number two is, what does that country or region want from the United States of America? And question three is, does what America is providing get America what it needs? And where that leads me to is, if it doesn't, we somehow spoke past one another. We didn't have the conversation that we needed to have, or in part we're being played for suckers. And I won't pretend to speak for President Trump, but I will say I know that he doesn't believe in America being played for a sucker.
That's a really terrific answer. And can you also apply that specifically to the issue of support to the issue of support for Ukraine? These issues will come up early, I would guess, in your chairmanship.
Yeah, I'm not going to forecast what the president is going to say there, but I think the most important thing that the president brings to the Ukraine conversation, as is assessed by every foreign intelligence agency across the globe, that for President Trump, his yes is yes and his no is no. And if they don't think that's the case, they are rolling the dice in a very serious way. That is the most powerful thing that he brings to the table. And I think second to that is his acute recognition of the tools that America brings to bear, kinetically through our military and our military supply chain, diplomatically through our relationships, and economically through the forces that we bear, both by the goods that we intake and the commerce that we allow across the globe. And so I think the awareness of all of those things, both for our adversaries and all of those abroad, of how the president operates in terms of the decisions that he makes and the way that he recognizes all the tools at our disposal, I think make for a situation for Ukraine that he will come in, he will have a direction that he wants to go, and it will be recognized by our partners, whether it be NATO, whether it be the EU, whether it be any individual nation that just wants to have a conversation, whether it be Vladimir Putin or Zelensky or any of them, as, okay, that's where he is dug in and that's what we have to work around.
Clarity, question of clarity. Anything you'd like to respond to that you've heard Congressman Meeks and ahead of a question that I will ask beyond that, which is, it's really hard, I think, at times to separate domestic policy, domestic issues from foreign issues, infrastructure, workforce development, immigration, education. So in your chairmanship and in your time in the Congress, have you seen those intersect with each other, but you also may want to respond.
Yeah, let me just say this, because I think that there's things where we may have a fundamental difference. Mm. The world is more interconnected now than ever. There's countries that are participating and have their concerns also. And if we're going to be successful, we've got to figure out how to work together. That's what diplomacy is all about. That's why, you know, we have a State Department. That's why we have ambassadors, so that we can make sure. One of the things that I learned early on coming into Congress, and I had a conversation at that time with former President Clinton. And I asked President Clinton, this was in the year 2000, what going out of the presidency surprised him most than when he came in. And he said that he found that he got more things and more agreement with our allies and our countries when we showed them respect, as opposed to just militarily threatening them. He said that we need to figure out how, whether the country's big or small, and there's times that you do have to back it up with a big stick if individuals do not come with the same values and they try to take advantage of those values and move forward. This is what the whole idea is, to try to make sure that we have a playing field that is level, that is values-based, and the values of who we are as Americans. And we can lead their regards as that indispensable nation, because what we can do and what we should be doing, instead of creating conflict, we resolve conflict. That's who we have been as the United States of America. We did that in World War I. We did that in World War II. When other countries caused conflict, we got involved to resolve the conflict and work together to bring other nations together. And that's why we have a NATO. Significantly important. That's why it's important to have relationships. When the biggest, one of the biggest, and I guess these are, you know, something that may come up later, the whole question is with China. Is because if we don't do that, China will fill a vacuum. And countries will see that they, if they can't get their interests also included therein, they will go somewhere else. And we've seen that. We've seen it already in regards to something that's not popular within my own party. We didn't pass, we didn't get it done under Barack Obama, and then we decided to pull completely out of any trade agreements with TPP, et cetera. So what makes us a safer country is when we're working and we're trading, that's economically, it brings costs down, it brings inflation down, it makes us work collectively together in that regards. When you think of supply chains, that becomes important. And that's why we need to make sure that there is further manufacturing in the United States, that we have supply chains leading out of the United States, but also have it at friendly places and not be completely dependent upon China. We also see it in healthcare, how we're interconnected, because something can happen on the other side of the globe. It's going to affect us right here domestically in the United States, whether it be health, whether it be financial services. So we can't live on an island separate from everyone else. At times, and I know I've had this also, when we need, for example, a vote in the UN. And I call some and they say, oh, and I've called countries, now you are calling me? We've got to show up, we've got to be there. That's what China is doing. That's part of the global competition that we're having with China, is with the rest of the world. That's why relationships in Asia and the Pacific are important. Their economies are important, they're concerned about their economies. And they would prefer us as the country of choice. But if we're not, their only other alternative is to depend upon China. When we talk about natural resources and what we need for the future, much of that is on the continent of Africa. We ignore Africa and some of the other poorest countries in the world. We're ignoring and hurting ourselves. That's not in our best interest. And so to help develop and create institutions and move forward and be concerned about humanitarian issues in other places of the world, that's in our interest. And when we spend money in those areas, it's an investment. It's not a waste of the United States money. It's an investment that we're looking at, and we want to get a return on that investment now and in the future. And I'm shocked at times when we have this dialogue and conversation and people talk about we should not be giving any foreign aid or anything of that nature. Most people think it's 25% of the budget or it's 15% of the budget. It's less than 1%. It's one of the best investments that I believe that the United States of America makes for us and our people, both internationally and domestically.
I think this is a good place for a little more conversation.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that you're drawing some differences here. I'm going to ask one follow-up, then I want you to have your response to what you've just heard, because it sounds to me that what you just said was really your questioning of the America First approach, or the quote that Chairman Mas came up with, every diplomat, every dollar puts America first. Is that what you're differing with what you just said?
No, what I really would say is that you can't go into, in a diplomatic way, say, I don't care about, I just want to know what America's going to get out of this.
Yeah.
And so it's America first, and to one degree that means it's America only. We're not the only ones in this planet. We share this planet. We see what's taking place in the United States with climate change.
Yeah.
And we talk about it, I mean, it's clear. If you talk to any science, when you see the unprecedented fires and winds and hurricanes that we're having around the world, We all live on this planet together. It's not just us. We've got to work together. We share this planet.
Chairman Mass.
Yeah, I would repeat the quote to begin with, because I think perhaps the second sentence was missed. So one was, what does America need from each country or region? The second was, what does that country or region want from America? That is the other side of it. But if you're not talking about where that gets you to, then you're not having the right conversation. And he did agree, my colleague, that we have to have a long-lasting path going forward. As we move forward in these relationships, we want them to be long-lasting, but it means making sure that we recognize if a country's asking for chicken, that we're not giving them fish. Or to be more provocative, if they're asking for chicken, we're not giving them LGBTQI, trans, whatever. Something that doesn't make us the partner of choice because of the way that we are operating on specific issues. And again, if there's not a recognition for what our side of that is as the United States of America, recognizing that you have weight classes, to bring something else into the conversation, you have weight classes in boxing and wrestling for very specific reasons. And we don't fight in the welterweight class. We are the heavyweight class. We are the United States of America. And if we're not recognizing that about ourselves, then we are doing ourselves a disservice.
So apply this a little bit now. Congressman Meeks was talking about foreign aid being a bargain. Do you agree with that? Humanitarian aid also comes into the committee. Would you look at that differently? You've prescribed a colonoscopy for the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can talk a little bit what you mean by that as well, because last time I went through that, I lost a lot of weight. But
I think I had that going on right around the occurrence of my chairmanship, so it was on my mind to use that word. Look, the two go hand in hand. I chaired the Foreign Affairs Oversight Subcommittee prior to being Foreign Affairs full committee chairman. And I can tell you that across the board, I dug into grants and programs that were provocative and counter-American, to say the least. Let's not be hypothetical about this. When you have the State Department doing grants in Ecuador at $20,000 a pop for drag shows, that's not something that I put into America First policy. Building a stage for a drag show is not building infrastructure. When I see the State Department expanding atheism in Nepal through Humanist International for $500,000 grants, that's not something that I think my constituents, the American people, want to see their State Department doing. I'm not sure how that makes America the partner of choice. And I use those as specific examples to say, You have to look at specifically where the dollars are going. You can't just go and say, well, that supports religious freedom or that supports democracy, so we're just going to do it without asking any questions. That is a serious failure of our role as overseers of the executive branch, any part of the executive branch, to not look at the dollars specifically. And that's where I say the State Department absolutely needs a colonoscopy about whether the diplomats and the dollars are putting America first. I'm going to expound on that for one more second, because if you're a diplomat that's signing off on some of these grants to do these things and then lying to Congress about it, saying, no, we didn't do that. No, that didn't take place. No, we're going to hide from you the full slide deck of what we actually produced for this country and tell you it doesn't exist until you actually go out there and find it. If they're going to be diplomats that send emails out to their staffs that say, or to people in their sphere that say, hey, don't word it in this way because Congress can see that, and then they're going to know, don't change the program that you're doing, just don't tell us about it. They should be on notice. I hope there's a chilling effect. Those are diplomats that are not putting America first, and the dollars that they are moving are not putting America first, and we will be looking for them. That's what a colonoscopy means.
Congressman, I'm going to have you respond to this. I'm going to try to pick up one or two questions.
Let me just say something. What's really important, because we've also got to know that we're dealing with human beings. And one of the most successful programs that we have that we couldn't agree with and get something done on, for example, is PEPFAR. It saved millions of lives. Millions of people. We don't reauthorize PEPFAR. The life of hundreds of thousands of children will die. So not to reauthorize PEPFAR and to disregard a continent that is important domestically to us also for the future of the minerals, et cetera, that we need, is dangerous to us. Because then somebody's going to step up to do it. And guess who that's going to be? China.
Well, unless I see a question, I'm going to go to China, but the question you didn't get to ask earlier today.
Hopefully it won't be too controversial or provocative. My name is Kemba Walden.
Those are the best ones.
I'm hoping it's not. My name is Kemba Walden. I'm the president of Paladin Global Institute. And before becoming the president of the PGI, I was the acting national cyber director in the White House. And one of the newest offices created, the Office of National Cyber Director. And my question is about the Bureau for Cyber and Digital Policy. Everything that we do, everything that we hope for, there's a digital component to it. Every conflict, our economy, there's a digital component to it. The restructuring of war-torn countries, the opportunity for prosperity, there's a digital component to it. So my question is, how do you view the Bureau in this new environment? What is the evolution for the Bureau in participating in this digital infrastructure that we live in?
For myself, importantly, I took a very specific look at all of the bureaus, all of the branches that fall within the State Department organizational chart as I was organizing the subcommittee. So it's not just that the subcommittees are organized by the regions of the STANs and the Indo-Asia area, and then Asia and the Pacific area, and Europe and Western Hemisphere, and Middle East and North Africa, and Africa, and Oversight and Intelligence. Those are the subcommittees by name. But they're much more specifically delineated the areas of the State Department that they have. That being one of them very specifically that I took a look at because it is so important to us, decided specifically to put it under who will be the subcommittee chairman, Representative Corey Mills of Florida, in the Oversight and Intelligence Subcommittee because, again, I thought this was something that fit best under the intelligence side of what we are looking at, being oversight and intelligence, and that being the cyber side falling within that, what I thought fit best within that portfolio.
And I think that's right. And it's something that I do agree with the chairman on that I saw that he had put out. You know, there's times that when you talk about cybersecurity, it's important. It's important to get as much information as we can. And unfortunately, sometimes we don't get all of the information that the intelligence community has. And the chairman has said that he thinks that it's important for us to get as much information on jurisdictional matters from the Intelligence Committee as the Intelligence Committee, from the Intelligence, as they have. I agree with him 100%. Because then we're not making our determinations based upon intelligence and facts. We need to know so that we can make sure that then we're coming with something that's not out of the blue, but based upon the intelligence that's there that should be shared with us. I found even at times, Mr. Chairman, when we travel, and I'm traveling and it happens to be, they separate us. So they say only the Intel Committee, even when I was the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, I couldn't get in the room. That does not make sense. And so when I heard you say that we need to get in there and be allowed in, I agree with you 100%.
Thank you.
Chalk that up.
Yeah, he didn't have his camera up. Could we do that?
I think you got it right.
Looking for more questions, please. Identify you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much. My name is Roby Kakonge, and I'm Uganda's ambassador. I want to thank the people of America for their generosity in PEPFAR, and please, we still need PEPFAR. But my question also is that we stood with America in Somalia. We host nearly 2 million refugees in our country. But what we would ask of America is for us to agree to disagree when it comes to issues of LGBT. We have situations where we're no longer getting visas, but yet people of different persuasion get those visas. We are no longer an AGOA, we have travel advisories, we have all sorts of things. And many of them just came out of social media and just, we never had like a decent conversation. So we ask of America is that we stand with you as a country of choice. China's there and all those other ones are there. And also, we're not poor. Can we reconsider trade rather than aid? So we want to reset the button, and we just want to make sure that there are no LGBT flags hanging over the embassies and all sorts of things out of culture respects. Not that we disagree that people should have choices, but we also have certain values. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador. Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Just goes to the point again, are the actions that we're taking making America the partner of choice in that country or region, or are they not? And if we're not very specifically evaluating that, we're doing ourselves a disservice.
Well, and I agree with particularly the fact that let's look at it as trade as opposed to aid. We've got to renew AGOA. We need to work and make sure there's opportunities. You know, when you look at some of the programs, like for example, the DFC, been working with Africa with their International Continental Trade Agreement, trying to figure out how we can make sure that the resources. And I was just talking to someone recently, and I'm gonna I'm going to do a podcast on this, and I'm going to, you know, Africa never gets or keeps the resources that it has. It all seems to go somewhere else. And this was something recently that was told to me that the big thing now is African music. But I'm told that there's not one company there. All of the resources come out, they get the music, the performers, but the money for the production and everything else is never in the country. So it benefits America, to me, when we have countries that are fully developed, that have institutions. We help strengthen those institutions where they may not be, because if you stabilize them, if they're stable and good and rules-based countries, that's beneficial to all democratic countries across the world. And I think that's what the goal is, and we need to do, and that no one is left out. Made a huge shift, I think that's important, where you know, you have other nations as part of the G20. Africa was just included into the G20, so that other voices are heard there and not forgotten about, because that's important also. And so being inclusive in that regard is important. That there's going to be things that we do have differences on. And those differences, that's, you know, just happens. And so we need to have that kind of conversation and go back and forth, but hopefully without losing hundreds of thousands of lives as a result. The bottom line to me is still trying to make sure that people have, you know, a equal and a good opportunity to live out. Because I, you know, and here's where beliefs do come into this. I believe we are all human beings. And because I happen to be in the United States, does it make me a better human being than somebody from someplace else? Just happen to be, you know, born one place or the other, or taken one place from another. So for me, it becomes really important in that regards because, look, my ancestors was taken from the continent of Africa. But now we got to figure out how do we move and we get things and work collectively together. That's what the key is, so that we can be better and improve, and as our nation said, striving to be a more perfect union, to have striving to have, I believe, a more perfect world. And what I look at is not just right now, it's the future. For me, everything that we do is not for me. It's for my grandchildren and other children yet unborn. Is this place that we share, will it still be here for them? And the decisions that we make now are decisions that are going to be looked at, not by me, because I'll be gone, but by those that are still here 50, 60 years from now. Just as we look at the decisions that was made 50, 60 years ago. Some were right, some were wrong. Try to fix what we did wrong and make it right so it's better in the future. And I think that's how we need to look at the continent, but other places all over the world.
Thank you, Congressman. Mark, please.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. Mr. Chairman, congratulations on the role, and thank you very much to you and your staff. You guys were critical on helping resolve a hostage situation I was working on, so I deeply appreciate there are four people that went home to their families over Christmas because of your staff, so thank you. As you know, I teach at Georgetown, also a TV producer and a lawyer, but early in my career, I worked at the White House for President George W. Bush and for Robert Gates as a special assistant, and in that time, I've seen how challenging the world is that you face every day. And in my earlier chapter, I was at the War Crimes Tribunal, where I spent 3 years investigating, prosecuting genocide cases. One of the things I think does not get often attention here is the persecution, not of all people, particularly of Christians. There are some serious places in the world with serious challenges with Christian communities, and I just would like you to just add your thoughts to how you're looking at this as your new role as chair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. No, I think you bring up a great point. Where any religion is marginalized, it's something that we do care about and do pay attention to. Everything, not to reiterate what I said too many times, does fall under the conversation for our State Department is, how is dealing with that situation making us the partner? What does that do for that relationship? And we have to weigh that accordingly. And I know Secretary Rubio and President Trump will be conducting our foreign policy as such. Now to go to, I guess, something that I wanted to touch on from what Gregory Meeks just said, maybe just to put a little color on something. I think you said one of the most important things, and that is, I don't know who in this room is, probably many have been in service, but I don't know who is still in military service, as an example. And if you have served or are serving, thank you very much for your service. That being said, the time for most of us, it's not an insult to anybody, but the time for most of us to put on body armor, to wear a helmet, night vision optics, to load our kit up with 10 magazines of 20 rounds apiece or a sidearm, everything that you need to save the life of a friend or take the life of an enemy. The time for most of us to step onto a battlefield has come and gone. The ones that have to do that are my kids,
yeah,
and your grandkids and your kids, those of you that have young kids as well. And I think that is the light through which, the lens through which both of us, and hopefully all of us, take a very serious look at the foreign policy that we are conducting, is what position does that put in those that we leave behind or those that we leave the world to? And I can tell you that's how I look at it.
So. Great answer. My final question from me, China's come up several times, so let's end there. And maybe Mr. Chairman, you can go first, and then Congressman Meeks. There's so much there. There's trade. There's Taiwan. There's property theft. Where do you set your priority? How, first of all, how big of a priority is it going to be for you Mr. Chairman, for the committee? And then second of all, what do you prioritize within this gigantic bilateral relationship with China?
Probably not a surprise. Foreign policy will be led by the executive branch, by President Trump and Secretary Rubio, and that we certainly will work to create the right pathways to support that foreign policy. And it's not a secret to many in here. One of his favorite words is tariff, and I mean that literally. This was a word that was used in the first 4 years of the administration to start at 25% and then go to 50, and Xi Jinping was saying, that still doesn't hurt, so it went to 75. And I think by the time it got to 75 or 100%, there was a phone call saying, hey, you know, you're down to Palm Beach, hey, you're killing me with this. That matters, and that will be a part of the policy to recognize that just as much as we have so much industry that's reliant upon goods that are coming out of China, they're reliant upon having to sell to us or to our allies. And to not be able to sell to us or to EU or others absolutely puts them in a pinch. My colleague spoke about how interconnected that we all are today. And so the administration will have a very healthy look at all of those as tools at play, and we will be working to support that. And the global look at this goes beyond just looking at Asia. It goes to looking at where are some of our allied nations, like Israel, conducting policies that change global battlefields and global landscapes. And to put color on that, I would say if you have an Israel that's making reliable Iranian energy a thing of the past for them to even keep their lights on, well, you can't run oil exploration and refining, which means that they don't have the capability to export 4 to 6 million barrels a day to China, which puts them in a hell of a different pinch than what they're in right now, and they have to find a place to make up that glut. If they can't reliably produce drones, then that affects the battlefield between Russia and Ukraine. If they have impediments to their expansion of their nuclear infrastructure, well, that's good for every single nation and region across the globe. And so I think there's a recognition of both of those things: what we do economically, what hurts our adversaries, or what are the sticks that we have to use, what are the carrots that we have to use, and what are the alliances that we have that reshape the battlefields that we have to deal with.
Thank you.
So I'll say this. We were a separate branch of government. And just as what took place during the Biden administration, Chairman Bass, rightfully so, criticized and looked at what the Biden administration's foreign policy was, where he disagreed. That's the role, that's the reason why we have a Congress in the first place, because it's built on checks and balances, and not just one person deciding everything, because that's what a king does. We have this constitution and this democracy where we have separate branches of government: the legislative, the judicial, and the executive. And so when we had oversight, it was clearly to oversight President Biden on both sides of the aisle, because there are certain things that President Biden did that I didn't agree with and fought and tried to get him to change and to do certain things, because that's my role in Congress. And I think that's what continues, that's what keeps our democracy healthy. That's what separates us from others. We can never give up that authority, ever. Then we won't have who we are. This is what we look at with other dictatorial governments. This is the problem that some of us have with Vladimir Putin. There is no check or balance. We must have it. It's essential. We were built upon it. It's part of our constitution. It's what I'm proud of. You know, I can only talk about certain things based upon who I am as an African American. In World War II, when the country was segregated, You had African Americans. I just finished reading a book about an airman from Tuskegee who suffered all kinds of things, but he believed in this country. So he got in that airplane and went to that training and went to World War II, even though he couldn't eat at a lunch counter with anybody else, fighting for this country and its democracy. Not for him, but hopefully for somebody like me, would have an opportunity someday. Knew that he wouldn't see it, but thought that the basics of this institution was in place so that it could happen. And guess what? Here I sit today. But for those kind of sacrifices, but for the belief in this country, that's who we are. And I'll tell you this, I'll end on this. I really respect this man because he stood up for this country. He lost his limbs. There's nothing, no bigger sacrifice than that. So even if we disagree, and that's what this country should be about, even if we disagree on the policy, we should always agree on the country and who we are and our institutions. And he's shown it. He's had the courage to do it. And so therefore, no matter whether we agree or disagree, because sometimes we focused on that, it's about whether we respect one another. And one thing I can always, and I can guarantee you, Mr. Chairman, I will always respect you because you've shown that you love this country.
Thank you again, Mr. Meeks.
I think that's the right spot to close. Chairman Mast, former Chairman Meeks, thank you so much for this very lively conversation.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.